Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, it's J. Michael Michael here for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you can't find anything worth listening to on the AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA. It's a .com, so we have it all, from sports to music to self-help to just about anything, including talk. And right now, we have the new writer's favorite show, The Writer's Block. So how about you just sit back, you pour yourself another glass of wine, grab another box of chocolates, and enjoy, because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, Russ, care to make a guess?
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
There you go. It was actually Richard Wagner, who unfortunately was an anti-Semite.
Sounds like we're all over-modulating.
We might be. It's the new, everything is new, so it's.
Do you
it's
have worked. Our maybe our pots are up too high?
They might be here. Let me kind of run them down a little bit.
Yeah,
no, that's much better.
Much better.
Anyway. It's LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, sitting in studio tonight with Mr. Russ Avison.
Yay, hello.
Hello, the dog man himself. One of the reasons why Bella didn't come over this week.
Yes.
Because they never started painting.
Yeah, you said they're not going to start until the 13th.
Well, now like. I talked him into starting on Saturday because I got to get it done. I got to get the house on the market.
Because you want to get the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and our last show is the 13th of June, so. Our last live show.
Yes, the 13th.
Yeah. So you're coming right at the great time.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I'm telling you.
Before we all jump off the cliff.
So anyway, it's got a great guest in here tonight. His book is phenomenal. You read it?
Yes, I did.
Yes, I did too. I love stuff like that because it's just like inspirational.
But I don't give a crap now because he plays hockey. That was the most important thing.
Well, I kind of figured.
That's my credibility.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me see. Let me get to his brief bio here because he's quite a tenured individual here. Oh, doesn't even look like you. You look just like your father. Did you know that? I told you that the other day.
I've been told that, yes.
Yeah, you do. You really do.
You look like my father, too.
Especially that picture in the front of your book. Okay, we have a gentleman sitting in our studio tonight that's an export and import from California to New York, back to California, back to New York. So he was raised in Long Island, New York. He earned both a BS, computer science, and an MBA from Columbia University, an expert in the field of troubled and distressed companies, and that's all I'm going to go with there, as per his request. So I mean, I'm going to let
don't
him
need
just,
any more enemies.
I'm right? just I, no, he doesn't. I'm just going to let him just do his own thing because welcome to the writer's block, Mr. Jack Hirsch. This is where we usually say thanks for the clap. But anyway,
and thanks for having me.
Oh, you know what? It's a pleasure having you here. It's your book was phenomenal. His book is Escape from the Nazi Death March.
Death March Escape.
Death March Escape, yeah. I don't have it in front of me, but I you know, and it's from Mathausen, which is, I just watched a movie the other day about Mathausen.
Yeah.
The photographer of Mathausen. Did you see that movie?
I haven't seen it yet.
It's excellent.
Yes, it's a remarkable story. And in fact, it was a lead into what I'd done because a photograph, not done by that photographer, but a Mathausen, a photograph that was taken right after just before my father had gone to Mathausen, appeared on their website.
Yeah, he's
and that triggered everything.
The guy was prolific, the photographer.
I've heard that.
Unfortunately for him, all the people that were working for him, all the Jewish laborers, stole all his negatives, and they hid them throughout the camp everywhere. They had him, you know, they had a hooker's barracks there. I didn't realize that they did.
In Guzin, they did.
Yeah, in Guzin, and well, Guzin won.
Guzin won.
Not right. Two. Two was like.
Guzin two is gone.
It's, yeah, well, that was not a place you ever wanted to go anyway.
And there was only one 3, if I remember reading correctly.
Yes,
there
was.
Yeah, Guzin 1 was the one, that was the labor one that was okay to be at if you had to be someplace.
Which is where my father was.
Right, and then Guzin 2 was where they had the guys carrying the 100-pound rucksacks up the hill and the steps.
Well, they both were, actually.
Yeah.
But Guzin 2's reputation was that it was the most horrific of this trio of horrific
of the three,
camps.
Right.
Mutthausen, Guzin 1, and Guzin 2.
Right.
It just had the most abominable guards and capos there. It was made out of wood, the entire building, the entire facility. And so because of a typhus epidemic at the end of the war, they raised it to the ground.
Yeah, it's kind of a real – what they say was it was kind of slapped together, too.
It wasn't
very well built.
Correct.
As a matter of fact, they said the guard towers used to sway in the breeze. But anyway, the story was phenomenal. The movie was phenomenal. It was very well done, and it was like right to the point. It didn't miss anything. In fact, if you look up the photographer of Mutthausen, it's actually follows the story and the movie follow each other right down the line.
Wow.
And unfortunately, the photographer lost. He was executed at the end of the war because he was pretty much a war criminal. As were they all. But this story, Jack's story, is his father twice got away. Yes. Got away from the death marches that were leaving as the Soviets and the Americans were closing in on the camps.
You know, what I found really interesting was that it wasn't just all Jews. In fact, there were a lot of other people that were just dissidents, and there were criminals, of course, too. But it was not a majority of Jews.
Well, not only was it not a majority, there was very, very few Jews there. In fact, there's one of the theories behind the fact that why my father spent part of the winter of 1944 into 45 in the infirmary was because the inmates in Mutthausen didn't want Jews there. So if you think of concentration camps, you normally get sort of word association. You think concentration camps, you think Jews.
Correct.
That is essentially correct. But not all of them were that. All the death camps, so for instance, Birkenau or Treblinka were death camps. They were all designed for Jews.
Mm-hmm.
3-4 million people killed in Birkenau, the majority of them Jews. But work camps, such as Auschwitz, were not necessarily all Jews. And in fact, Mutthausen was initially not for Jews. The only time Jews were sent there, for the most part, 2,000 Jews were sent there before 1944. But in the middle of spring of 44, when the Hungarian Jews were deported to concentration camps, some of them, including my father, were sent to Mutthausen because they were running out of people to kill. As you pointed out, Russ, the people who were normally sent there were intelligentsia, communists, people they didn't
dissidents,
people they didn't want in their society, criminals, incorrigible criminals. It was where you went. And by the way, when you went there, you were not expected to return. It was a work camp where you were going to be worked to death. Auschwitz was not where you were being worked to death. You were being worked, fed miserably, treated horribly, likely to die, but you weren't sent there purposely to die. In Mutthausen, you were being sent there purposely to die. And then my father and a few thousand Jews were sent there around his time. Mm-hmm. So when you make the point about concentration camps, you're being surprised that there were non-Jews there. Mm-hmm. In fact, in this camp, it was mostly non-Jews.
Right. There was a lot of gypsies.
There were gypsies there.
And okay. Soviets as well, Russians.
Interesting that you say that. So the infirmary in Mutthausen was originally called Russenlager, or Russian camp. Mm-hmm. And then they changed the name to Sanitätslager, sanitary camp. But the reason it was called Russenlager, Russian camp, was because it was designed to house the influx of Russian prisoners. They had 5,000 to 10,000 at one point. But in the time it took to build, about 9 months to a year, they'd killed all the prisoners. So there was no Russians to put there. So instead, they made it into an infirmary. That characterizes for you what Mutthausen was like.
Right, right. And I know, because I've read a lot of stories, not stories, but true factual books about the camps and the guards, and some of them were the what do they call them, the
capos,
the capo commandos.
The capos ran commandos.
Right. Yeah, and they were the prisoner guys that were in charge.
Exactly.
And they would beat these guys senseless for no infraction.
For no infraction, no reason. My father has a story of being beaten nearly to death for a reason he has no idea. He thinks it might be he was carrying a heavy pipe with five others. He thinks maybe he was taller than the other four, than the other five.
Oh.
And he just got singled out and beaten. And this sort of goes into a little bit of what the book was about. Mm-hmm. My father was a interesting, funny, engaging, good-looking, or I would say good-looking guy.
Just
ask him. I can tell you. He was a very engaging life of the party guy. This is the man that I knew, you know, post concentration camp. When he would tell the story about nearly being beaten to death, he would laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, I mean, there's nothing funny about this. But one of my issues had been, well, why didn't I ever stop and say, why are you laughing? Why are you chuckling as you tell this story?
Mm-hmm.
Which I go into in the book about, well, what was it about me that didn't want to approach that? But back to my father's personality and the fact that he would laugh about this, you hear concentration camp survivor, you tend to get an image in your head.
Right.
First of all, visually, you may think of pictures of people in concentration camps.
Right.
You know, they weigh 70, 80, 90 pounds. They're all skin and bones. But also you think of the Elie Wiesels, not to take anything away from this brilliant man who did a remarkable job getting and keeping the word out, but you get the impression that survivors don't smile, don't tell jokes, they're morose, they're downbeat. My father was the exact opposite. You would never know about his past if not for the fact, unless you asked him.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was amazing about your dad was that his first escape lasted, what, an hour?
Yeah, an hour, yes.
Yeah, and that was only because he just walked out to go to the bathroom or something and just never came back.
What was interesting about that escape was that he had gotten caught up with refugees.
Right.
And, you know, I in working on the book, I went into the intersection there where he got caught up with refugees, and he turned with them.
Turned with them.
Right.
Turned,
yeah.
And one of the most remarkable things to me, okay, I've known the story my entire life. I stood in the middle of that intersection and kind of imagined what must have been like. How do you do this? How do you make that turn? And then, as you point out, so he made that turn. He goes 100 yards. He knocks on a door. Old woman answers the door. He says in fluent German, "Will you feed me?" And she takes him in, and 15 minutes after giving him food, she calls the SS on him. So, yeah, that was his.
Yeah,
But the second one was almost more remarkable because at that one, he went to the. He assumed he was done.
Right.
It was about a mile and a half after the first intersection.
Right.
This is a week and a half later. The rule in the death marches were if you went to the side of the road, they shot you.
They shot you, right.
And maybe they'd ask you if you could get up, depending on the compassion of the SS guards. And there were a few with a little bit of it, particularly towards the end of the war. So my father is toast. He weighs 80 pounds. He's suffering from typhus and tuberculosis and pneumonia all at the same time. He goes to the side of the road, go ahead and shoot me. SS trooper comes behind him, pulls out his pistol, puts it in the back of his neck. But it was 6 o'clock at night, cool, drizzling, and the cold steel of the gun on the back of my father's neck shocked him, and he jumped up. The SS trooper realizes he can't. He's just decided he's not going to shoot my dad.
Right.
He's standing. He walks away, and my dad realizes: A, there are no prisoners right where he is. B, there are no SS guards looking at him. The guys behind them are not looking at him. And C, there's a little path right there, for whatever reason, and he bolts down the path. Does 10 steps, throws himself into bushes. No one saw him do it. So, to ask myself, would have I had would I have that nerve?
I think that word would be balls.
Balls, yeah. No question about it. Would I have been able to do that? And I presume almost that the answer is no, but that was who my
Well,
dad
yes,
was.
But you aren't in the circumstances that your father was at that time.
Correct. And it's impossible to put myself there.
Right.
But I tried, and you know, I stood in that intersection, and I stood at the foot of that path where he ran down and that second escape, and I just don't know.
And it's amazing that the family that took him in,
the Friedmans,
yeah, they gladly helped him, and they helped him throughout the whole time. And then at the end, the old man says he didn't really want to do it. it was kind of like a dichotomy there.
That's a great point. So, okay, so you're giving my father's interpretation.
Right.
My father wondered, he felt like the guy just wasn't that happy to have seen my dad alive. But I think my father completely misinterpreted this
guy. It could have been.
I mean, the guy's old enough to be his father, or maybe even a little older than that. He's a Western Austrian, a taciturn, quiet, you know, strong-willed. He's saved my father's life. He's a great guy, but he's not an emotive guy. And my father's the youngest of eight from a very emotive family, and he's expecting more, and he's not getting it. And I think my father therefore presumed, well, I'm not getting what I'm expecting, therefore he's probably just not happy to see me. And I've my whole life, I believe my father just misinterpreted that.
Well, your dad was, what, 18 at the time?
18 when he went into the camp,
right.
19 when he went, because his birthday is in the summer, so 19 when he escaped.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also he, during the escape where he got away, is that he didn't think that those people knew he was a Jew.
That's exactly right. And he didn't want to tell them because he was afraid that they wouldn't treat him as well as they did. And then in being interviewed by a historian 20-odd years later, the family, the wife, said, we knew he was Jewish because only Jews were on those death marches. The route was the same every time. They were going within a quarter of a mile of the Friedman's home. And I should just point out, because there's been this confusion before, their name is Friedman. We're used to Friedmans being Jewish. They were not Jewish. And in fact, in looking for motives for why they saved my father's life, the concentration camp historians went back 100 years in baptismal certificates and are unequivocally certain these people are not Jewish. But so for whatever reason, my father didn't want them to know he was Jewish. They believed from the start that he was Jewish. And my only conclusion is that they did this because it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with my father's religion.
From looking at the story, that's how I felt too. Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about your impetus for going back there in the first place.
Sure. And that was amazing.
The book seems to me that it was all about a search for why your father had basically not told you all about these things. And then in 1997, I think, when he went back there, and he never told you about it.
Right.
So I think it seemed to me that was what got you going.
Yeah, so as you point out, I've known the story my entire life. Mm-hmm. My father told it, but he told it, and as I said, as I described him earlier, in this engaging, interesting way, that's the way he told it. And he never went deeply into what really happened. I mean, he would, as I pointed out when I said, well, he was nearly beaten to death. Mm-hmm. He described it in such a way, sort of like, you know, a couple of hits across the head. No. The guy was really nearly beaten to death. So I know this story, or whatever I know of it. And then in 2007, I don't know my father's gone back. I do know that he's done the Steven Spielberg Shoah tape, but it went in one ear, went out the other. I never wanted to watch it because I knew the story. What am I going to see? Mm-hmm. 2007, my cousin calls me up from Israel. She's my age. Her mother and my father were brother and sister. Her mother was a concentration camp survivor as well. Eight kids, only four survived. My cousin's mom and my father being two of the youngest. She calls me up, she says, Google your dad. My dad had been dead 6 years at this point, 2007. She says, Google your dad. He's on the internet. And my dad didn't even own a computer. Why would my dad be on the internet? Okay, fine. She says, Google Mutthausen and Dave Hirsch, and you'll see what comes up. And I Google Mutthausen and Dave Hirsch, and he's on the Mutthausen website. Now, I don't even know Mutthausen has a website. I'm not interested in any of this. I know my father's story. And by the way, I didn't even know he was on death marches because he didn't call them that. He called them transports.
Right.
Which is a German word and an English word. But the German word basically means how you get from point A to point B. So a transport could be a train ride. It could be a truck ride.
Yeah, bus, car, anyway.
And it could be a march. So I didn't know any of this. So I Google him. He's on their website. And this photograph, a headshot, essentially a model headshot photo of my dad, a photo that I've never seen before. I mean, I have a few photos of my dad from before the war, not this one, and it's not one that's close up, not one that is a classic headshot that anybody in L.A. would know what a headshot is.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so this photograph is there, and under the photograph is a couple sentences that says he was found by the Friedmans and rescued and kept until the Americans came through at the end of the war. I didn't tell him this. My father didn't tell him, and I subsequently learned that even though my dad went back, he didn't meet anyone or talk to anyone. How do they know this? And so I start this, as you point out, I started this investigative process to try to find out. But it took me years before I got on a plane and I went there. I started with dialogue back and forth in email. I learned a little bit of the story about the fact that there was a historian that in the 1960s had come across the family that rescued him. This historian was looking for proof that Austrians had resisted the Nazis, and a form of resistance would be hiding prisoners.
Sure.
So he walked the death march routes, knocking on doors, and he came across four stories of any sort where somebody helped a death march marcher. Two of them, they died within hours of being rescued. One of them actually was hidden for a few weeks and then now lives in Israel. And the fourth one, but the only double escapee, my dad. And the only person who, the only story that my father, that this historian could fill out and flesh out into pages worth of a story and really understand it. So he met the family, they told him what happened, and they gave him the photo, which then leads to the question, well, how do they have the photo? My dad didn't go to concentration camp with a photo in his back pocket. It's just not plausible. So I don't know for 100% certain how they have the photo.
And by the way, the headshot was taken before
the
all
war.
Of this happened. So
that's right. The headshot was taken when my father was 16 or 17, and he was a model in his hometown. Mm-hmm. Besides being working in his father's soap factory and being just a kid, he was a model in his hometown. I have some of the photos that I have now, I look at them and go, wait a minute, these were not family photos. These are photos of him modeling clothes.
Okay.
So it all sort of comes together. So they've got this photo. They know this story. So how does the historian get the photo? And it turns out that what happened, I'm surmising, mm-hmm. is that so after the war, my father spent 18 months in a hospital.
Right.
As I said, he had typhus. He had tuberculosis. He got peritonitis, which kills most people. He survived that. About a year after getting into the hospital, he's strong enough and kind of comes to a senses about the idea that, wait a minute, where's the other seven of my brothers and sisters? And so he decides to write home to sort of a general mailbox with the Jewish population of Dej, his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a response saying two of the brothers and one of the sisters are in fact alive. And so they start exchanging letters back and forth. I almost said emails. They start exchanging letters back and forth. They can't visit him because they're in the Russian zone. My father's in the American zone. This is when you couldn't easily get back and forth. So they exchange letters. They sent him a photograph of them showing what they now look like.
Right.
And this is where my supposition is. My father, you know, when back in the day before we had phones and, you know, if you met somebody you liked and you wanted to stay in touch with them, you might have given them a photo.
Sure. With your number and name in the back.
Exactly. And so I think my dad asked for a bunch of copies of that photo. And then when he was on a train after 18 months in the hospital, the train coincidentally stopped in that town where he was hidden. And they're sitting there on the platform for a few... They had to stop there because it's the border between the Russians and the Americans. They're mm-hmm. sitting there for half a day. He tells a station master, can you go find this family and just tell them that I'd like to say thank you for saving my life? The husband comes. They have a few-minute conversation. Another one of these not exciting conversations that,
right.
that confirmed for my dad, perhaps he wasn't that psyched about having saved my life,
right,
which
right.
I don't believe. And he gave him the photo. And then they give the historian the photo. The historian puts it in a book, doesn't get the book published. He dies. His kids give it to Mudhausen. Then Al Gore invents the internet, and they put it on the internet.
And the rest is, as they say, history.
And then I show up. And it sets me on this detective thing that lasted a decade.
That trip must have been phenomenal for you.
It was remarkable.
It had to have been.
I didn't know what to expect at all. I mean, you know, sometimes whenever you go places, you kind of think you know what might. I had no clue. I didn't, and I went alone. What I was unprepared for was the emotional impact. I mean, this is all part of why I ended up writing the book, is because, you know, I knew the story my whole life. There's something I'm gonna learn about mm-hmm. this story mm-hmm. wrong. When I stood in front of this building called the Stone Crusher, which is in Gusen, mm-hmm. which is still there, the rock mine in Gusen is no longer a working rock mine, but it is a rock mill, a granite mill, and the building, the Stone Crusher building, is there. And my dad spent every day for 7 or 8 months, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, moving 50 to 70 pound rocks on a mine cart between a storage area and that building. And I stood in front of that building knowing that I'm standing on the grounds my father stood at as a 100 pound 5'11" prisoner in the Nazis. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal. And then, as I said, when I stood in the intersection, that's another one. It's like I was suddenly there on April 1st or 2nd. We don't know the exact date, 1945. Or when I stood in front of the path on the second escape, it was April 16th. I was standing not within miles or yards. I was standing within inches of where my father sat down on the side of the road to be shot and killed.
Yes.
Inches. Because of the way, there was a small stream to my left, 10 feet away. There's a wall that goes 100 yards to my right, 10 feet away. And the path is a yard wide. And my father saw a path. He had to have been right in front of it. So when I stood there, I was standing where my father was standing. So when you say the impact of this trip, it was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And it took me probably as long as it took to write the book, which is about 2.5 years, it took me that long to come to grips with and learn how to express what the emotions that I...
Right. Now, he had told you that you had asked him about how did you get that the 100, 200-pound granite rocks to the crusher, and he said, well, we just pushed them. Yeah. That was amazing, and then you looked at it, and you go, that's 300 yards.
But that was your father's way of dealing, because everything to him, it's okay, it's not bad.
That had to have been to spare
so
you.
It had to be to spare me,
right,
and to spare himself.
Right.
I think, like, for instance, I talk about the typical day he must have experienced, but not because he ever told me his typical day, because he never did, because I never asked.
Right.
And if I asked, I think I would have gotten a shoulder shrug. I think he would have said, it was a day. You know, we got up, they fed us, we worked, they fed us for lunch, they fed us for dinner, we went to sleep. That's what he would probably have said.
Which doesn't sound bad.
No, right, exactly. But it's horrific. Mm-hmm. It's a concentration camp. It's one designed to work you to death.
Right.
There's nothing funny or engaging or light or amusing about this.
Right.
And yet I never asked any questions. So, the trip was the catalyst for me finally waking up.
You know, my father's still alive. He's 93 and a half.
Wow, good man.
And he lives at a senior living facility. And there's a woman there that I haven't seen for probably a year, so I don't know if she's still alive, but she was a survivor from Auschwitz. And she showed me the tattoo on her.
Only,
she has her number.
Only Auschwitz survivors have numbers.
Yes, she showed me that. But she has a book that she had put together that a lot of people contributed to, other survivors. But what I wanted to bring up about this woman is that when she explained about her experiences, it was very much in the way that you explained that your father talked about it. She has a great sense of humor. And when she talks about it, she told me how she and her cousin survived by laying on top of the pile of bodies.
Wow.
And until the guards went away, and that's how they made their escape.
Wow.
She lost one of her eyes working in a factory where they were making something with gunpowder, and something had gone off and got in her eye and burned her eye. But she talked about this as nonchalantly as we're just, you know, discussing the weather or hockey.
Right, right.
And so I think you might be right that this is the way they can cope with it,
yeah,
because it was so terrible.
I think the great, great majority of survivors, like a lot of war veterans, soldiers, their coping mechanism is to stay as far away from it as they can. Don't ask me. I'm not telling you. I'm never raising it. It's in a box. It's locked and sealed, and I'm not going there. But
and
some
then, of course,
of them,
they are all suffering from the PTSD.
Exactly,
and,
yes. Mm-hmm. And then some of them, if they're going to talk about it, like my dad, the woman you just described, and my father, mm-hmm. and my father's friends, the town that I grew up in, South Shore of Long Island, Long Beach, New York, there were a lot of survivors that had gone there. And most of my parents' friends were survivors, one or both of a couple. And they were, you know, they'd play gin rummy on Saturday nights, and they'd be cracking jokes about things that they'd experienced. That is their coping mechanism. It doesn't make it easier. And my problem was that my interpretation of what he went through was that, well, I guess it was just, I mean, it was dad, right? Dads are dads. There's nothing that they do is remarkable. You know, your father could be a CEO or an all-star, mm-hmm. but he's just dad to you.
Correct.
Right?
Sure.
And so he was just dad to me until I stood in front of the stone crusher, and suddenly he wasn't just dad anymore.
Right.
But, you know, you talk about the coping mechanisms. What's the alternative? Do you sit around and just you know, woe is me, and I suffered, and my life sucks.
And most people do that.
Right. I don't understand.
I'm with you on that.
I never understood black humor. You laugh along gratuitously to whoever's giving it to you.
Right.
But you don't really understand black humor until you're in a position where you're right in the middle of it.
Right.
And when you're in combat or you're in a war zone, black humor is the only thing that gets you through.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's the only thing that gets you through. And there's a lot of it. So I could totally get that. Totally get the fact that they can sit around and drink and play cards and laugh and joke about it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's camaraderie to them.
They're in that club.
Right. And you're not a member of that club.
Right. You know, there was I can't recall exactly what part of the book it was, but while I was reading it, it triggered me to think about something my mother always used to say to me, which was, in the face of all adversity, never lose your sense of humor. And I've always remembered that. And, you know, when things are really going down the crapper and you look around and you make jokes, you have to. I think it keeps everything in perspective.
I think that's 100% right. But one of the things I did, so again, back to the story of my dad being nearly beaten to death and laughing about it, I interpreted it as, and maybe it was a little bit of a mechanism, just a device I use in writing, because I did want to talk about this. But what this is my father laughing at the angel of death. It's like, you know, you're not. He was going in for surgery in a few months.
Right.
In the book, it's 2001. He has surgery coming up, and I haven't been in a Passover meal, a Seder, with my father. My father typically told the stories on Passover, because Passover, the story of the Jews leaving Egypt, escaping. So my father tells his escape story. I hadn't been there in a long time. The reason I went back is my father asked me to come back. I was living on the West Coast. He's still living in Long Beach, Long Island. He says, come back. I realize he wants me to come back. He wants to tell me the story, because he's got surgery coming up, open heart surgery, and he just sort of wants to remind himself he's a pretty tough guy, and I'm going to do that by telling Jackie, as that was called. Jekyll, exactly. I'm going to tell him the story again. But I also think when he laughed, that time he was laughing at the angel of death. It's like, you know, you got nothing on me. I got you this time. This time again, I've got you.
Sure.
And that was how I viewed it.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back. Russ, you have your paperwork right there in front of you?
I do.
It's your ad, so you might as well
I
do
see.
It.
I can do this. Do I have music to back me up on this one?
You do have music, and it's going to start
Go for it now. So, you are leaving on vacation. Your tickets have been purchased. Hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. Uh-oh. What about the dog? All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers is the place you want your dogs to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside among orange trees and grass. Whoops, I just went away.
That was me.
Uh-huh. Well, at All Dogs Rule, your dog gets to be, well, a dog. All Dogs Rule offers additional services, including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at www.alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. And when your pup returns home with that smile on his face, it will leave you wondering whose vacation was better.
The dogs.
Yes, indeed.
Indeedy. That's All Dogs Rule, and that is 805-524-1100.
You have that memorized. I'm so impressed.
I do that like once a week, pal. Okay, has cabin fever got you down? Turn your mind away from winter storms and things, and think spring. Now's the time to refresh your outlook. And what events do you have coming up? Outdoor music festivals, trip to the mountains, horseback ride adventures. Out West Shop has what you need to revive your spirits and reboot your wardrobe.
I think we should go right now.
I think we should. Cool hip boots, boho tops, stylish boots from Dan Post, and great-looking jackets are just a few of the fashion essentials offered for men and ladies. And find it all at www.outwestshop.com. Enter coupon code SPRING and save $10 on your original Oh, your order call. I don't even. This is Bobby Jean. Bobby Jean, I can't read your ad. Your order call. Oh, call toll free. 877-340-9378. Out West delivers the West door to door, coast to coast, and around the world. And remember, it's always a good day.
Now, I got to ask you, what is a boho top?
I have no clue. Bobby Jean, if you're listening, call in and tell them what the boho top is. Okay. I have no clue. I'm just here. All right. It is now 7:34. We are in studio with Mr. Jack Hirsch, and we've been talking about his book about his dad escaping from the Nazi death marches. And if you want to call in and talk to Jack now, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And we're back with Jack. We're back, Jack. How's that?
Jack, I have a question. In the beginning of the book, you talk about your family being in, and it was the town pronounced Dej?
Dej.
And okay. Now, that's in Romania?
Right now it's in Romania.
Right. It was Transylvania.
It's always been in Transylvania, but right. It was before World War I, it was Hungary. It was Austro-Hungary. Between the wars, it was Romania. During World War II, it was Hungary. Now it's back to Romania again.
Yeah, my daughter-in-law is from Transylvania.
Yeah, I've driven through it. It's gorgeous. Gorgeous. It's like, I'm an Easterner, it's like the Catskills or the Appalachians. It's rolling hills. It's not towering, you know, rocky crags like the Sierras. It's just it's gorgeous.
It has one just wonderful resident, Dracula.
Yes, indeed. So anyway, when your family was there and before the Germans came in, how did they, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, but how did they see things changing so dramatically, so quickly? And the only reason I ask that is because sometimes that same question is asked about what's going on in our country right now, and could things make a change that way?
Great question. And in fact, they didn't really see things changing that quickly. What they saw was a glacial shift. You know, there was always anti-Semitism that, that was sort of, you know, embedded within European culture. It didn't. It wasn't necessarily much more. Hungary became part of the Axis, and because of that, there weren't German troops in town until late 1943. And even when they came, they were basically logistics troops, guys who'd been on the Russian front, tired of fighting. Four of them lived with my parents, with my father and his parents. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a paradigm shift in behavior towards the Jews. There were laws that were similar to the Nuremberg laws. My grandfather owned a soap factory. He had to sell it to a non-Jew who was a good friend of his. My grandfather had been a cavalry soldier, and he had army buddies, and he sold it to an army buddy who allowed my grandfather and his kids, my father's generation, to work there. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that people talk about with the Jews in World War II is that how they all went like lambs to slaughter. The reality is they didn't know. Not even to say the great majority, 0.001% might have known. The rest of them did not know what they were going into. To me, the most amazing thing about what happened to the Jews is that 6 million of them were killed. But the second most amazing thing was that no one knew. To the point where my father and his family were going on those cattle cars to Auschwitz.
Right.
Where 17 out of 22 were killed within hours of arriving there. 7 out of 22 close family members. They didn't know. And they really believed
they were going just to be relocated.
They thought they were going to a relocation camp, a resettlement camp. They had no idea. I think that, you know, and I don't want to get too far into politics, but we are in a more divisive environment than I think we've ever been. But I think at the end of the day, we're Americans. And although, you know, everybody's tribal by nature to one degree or another, but
sure.
our American version of tribalism is not like the rest of the world.
Right.
It just isn't. You know, Brexit, they want out of there. They literally want to leave Europe. We don't have anything like that here. We just don't take it to that degree. Could it happen here? Well, after it happened in Europe in World War II and after it's happened in Africa, I imagine it could happen here, but I don't see it.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing when you were describing that they went to the I just had a brain fart. It was horrible. The ghetto.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The ghetto and, yes.
Yeah, and knowing it's an Italian word. And it's the ghetto that they went to, and they thought, well, there's going to be buildings. No, it's in the middle of the forest.
It's a forest. I've been there. It's they built a memorial. The townspeople built a memorial there. You hear ghetto, you think of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Right.
You think of you think of Brownsville in New York sometimes.
Right. Or, actually, right now I'm thinking of El Paso, Texas. And
yes. Yes. When we speak our language, images pop into your head.
Exactly.
No matter what the word is. Well, when you hear ghetto, you get images. It turns out that the images all have buildings in it. They were my father and his family and his townspeople. 7,000 Jews out of 15,000 people in the town were sent to a field. Here's some canvas. Here's some wood. Knock yourselves out. Field for 30 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Absurd. I mean, this is the 1900s.
Right.
This isn't the 1300s.
Well, yeah. See, that brings, again, coming back to the question about this country, but it makes me wonder, first of all, about humanity. I mean, there was none in that situation. And how people, even the SS soldiers, who a lot of them were killing the Jews. You know, you stop at the side of the road in the death march, you get shot. But this culture of thought, I don't understand it. I cannot understand how it could have been developed against. I mean, in this country, we have all sorts of cultural groups that are hated by some other group or talked, slanderous by another group. But to actually kill them.
You've dehumanized them. They're not human. And look, if you look at the history in the United States, there are certainly people who other people have dehumanized, and so they've the atrocities, lynchings, right? You don't do that to people that you consider your caliber. So in this country, there were people who believed African Americans were treated as if they're of a lower caliber, and the Jews and Gypsies, but mostly Jews, mm-hmm. were considered of a lower caliber human, or maybe just a subhuman.
Mm.
Certainly, the Nazis fostered it with this whole Aryan concept, right? So if you weren't an Aryan,
right.
then you. So you just, if you take that any of this dehumanization concept to the nth degree, well, the nth degree is, well, I could kill you, I could step on you because it's like a,
mm-hmm.
like
you're
I could
a
step on a bug, I could, exactly,
right.
like I could step on a bug.
And don't you think that's being perpetuated, say, against our neighbors to the south?
I do think so, to some degree. I just maybe I'm giving too much credit, but I just think that we haven't dehumanized them. We've done a lot bad.
But maybe these are the first steps toward that.
And I can't argue with
you. I mean, it's frightening.
Let's hope there's only a couple more years of it.
I can't argue with you, Russ. Taken to the nth degree, that's where you go.
And what disturbs me also is, like you said, maybe 0.001 percentage of the Jews saw what was happening, and the rest of them had no clue. That could be happening.
Well, the sad part about that whole story.
You're not wrong. I can't argue with it.
The sad part about the whole story is there were Jewish families that did escape it, and they came to the United States, and nobody would listen to them.
Yeah.
They were sucked up and shut up, and that was it.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to hear about it.
And there was the word
mm-hmm.
having gotten out of my syntax was terrible. But the word had gotten out to some degree or another mm-hmm. in very, very small doses, and no one believed it.
Right, exactly.
There was talk about begging Roosevelt to bomb Auschwitz, and that
right.
not having have happened. But I really do also believe, and I don't know this for certain, but I don't believe people really recognize that, the population of 6.3 million, 6 million are being killed.
Right.
They're being wiped off the face of the earth, or wiped off the earth.
Well, I don't think anybody really realized the scope of what was happening.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Until after the fact, it was like, oh my God.
But even today, there's Holocaust deniers.
There are Holocausts in Africa. Let's include the Armenians.
Or genocide.
Genocides, yes. They are happening. But yes, there are Holocaust deniers, which is just inexplicable to me. I actually had, of all the press I've gotten and all the times I've read things, there was the Daily Mail in the UK wrote me up soon after it came out in England, which was in late 2018. And somebody wrote and said, well, here's just another example of something, it's a made-up story, and and took the Daily Mail article and said, this couldn't have happened and that couldn't have happened. Well, maybe this guy will one day walk around with me to the concentration camp and then we can see whether it happened.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Oh, but they'll never do that.
Of course they'll never do that because it would prove them wrong.
Yeah. By the way, was this the first book you've written?
It's not the first book I wrote. I wrote a book about 20 years ago, a murder mystery. I wrote an article. My son's physically disabled, and I wrote a story that ran in the New York Times. And I have friends who are reporters because of research that I do for a living. Helps to talk to reporters, and they all said to me, you know, you were a writer. This was 25-odd years ago. And then I was working with in an environment where there were people I just didn't like that much, and I decided I'm going to use that as a basis for just to sort of get it off my chest. I'm going to write a story, a murder mystery around some of these people, and by the time I got done with it, these people weren't even in it. But I ended up with a 130,000 word murder mystery, and I got an agent, and I spent 2 years writing and editing it. It was a great process. We couldn't get a big name publisher to take it. So my agent says to me, look, if you want to be a writer, you got to write more than one book. So why don't you write another one? And it took me 2 years, and I wrote another murder mystery, and it was better written and less interesting. And then, and then I started a third one. So now I'm about 6 years into this process, and it was really great. And then after about 40,000 words, I lost the muse. It's just, it wasn't my day job. My day job was tough enough, and raising three kids, one of whom is physically disabled, was tough enough, and I just put it away.
Yeah.
And then to sort of fast forward to this book, I got to a point where I was really beginning to understand my father's story and really beginning to understand my issues around the story. And then I had a dinner, late 2015, it was a business dinner. And every once in a while, this story would come up, my father's story would come up, and I would tell the story. For some reason, in late December 2015, the story came up. I told the story to this business dinner. The next day, one of the guys at dinner calls me up and says, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I have never met a survivor. I have never met anyone that I'm aware of is related to a survivor. I have never heard of a story like this in my life. It has changed my life overnight. It has changed my perspective on life. It has changed how I view the difficulties in my life. Nothing will ever be the same again. And I thought, if that's true of him, that's got to be true of thousands of people, millions of people. And I think I might be a little bit of a writer. And I've got a story to tell. And I decided to try to write it.
Well, it is an inspirational book, for sure.
Thank you.
And I think you are a writer.
And I think you made the cut, Jack.
Thank you very much. The accidental writer, right?
I actually, it's much better than the drivel I gave you. No, I didn't. That's not drivel. I write some pretty good stories, but
you do.
Yeah,
you do.
Yeah, but I write westerns.
I'm looking forward to reading your
book. I write.
This
nothing.
Is actually one of the best books I've ever written.
I write nothing.
I keep telling him, write it. We'll format and edit and everything for you. And
I did the ad.
You did. Oh, I need that back. Oh. Anyway, we're almost out of time, and I just want to forego the normal question that we ask everybody because it's just been too interesting talking to you about other stuff. So what we normally ask you, did you ever have writer's block? And if you did, how did you get out of it? But at this point, I don't care. Yeah.
and I would have to admit the answer is no. I've had points where I'm not sure where to go, but I knew I had direction in both my father's story and my story. So.
Yeah, we have, around here we call it writer's pause because it's just, I mean, occasionally you get moving in a direction that you don't want to go and you got to stop and back up. But see, you didn't have to worry about dialogue. You didn't have to worry about story. It was already there.
It was there. And even the dialogue, so I had this tape that my father had done for the Spielberg's project, the Shoah project. And so when there is quotes in the book, it is quotes from my father on that tape.
Which is phenomenal that you had that.
Yes, but again, back to my story, I didn't look at it until my cousin called me and told me about this photograph, and then I'm like, well, wait a minute, I guess I could, you know, remind myself of the story because I hadn't heard it in years.
But then you were on a mission. I mean, once this happened, you said, why didn't my father take me?
Yes.
Why didn't we go together and do this? And that got your wheels going, and then I don't think you were stoppable.
I wasn't, but it did take a long time because they didn't have a lot of information. In 2007, 8, 9, they didn't know a lot. They didn't know the death march route, for instance.
Really?
It was only There was a group of historians around Mauthausen who only around then began to really dig into what happened to the Jews there, again, because the Jews were a very insignificant part of Mauthausen.
Right.
Not insignificant to any one of them.
Of course.
But in the big picture, the hundreds of thousands of people incarcerated in Mauthausen and the perhaps 100,000+ who were killed in Mauthausen, the Jews were a very small part of that.
Right.
But there is a series of historians, none of whom are Jewish, who have taken it upon themselves to make sure no one forgets Mauthausen, no one forgets the story of the prisoners in Mauthausen, no one forgets the story of the Jews of Mauthausen.
Why do you think it took so long for somebody to start investigating?
I think in Austria, more than Germany, there was a sense of, and I'm reading between the lines a little bit of hearing from historians, there was a sense of not wanting to open this box. You know, we were we the Austrians felt that they wanted to feel they were as much victims as anybody else in Europe. Whereas you would normally, looking from the outside, say, well, wait a minute, it was Anschluss in 1938. You were partners with the Germans, but the Austrians don't want to see it that way. And in fact, they're partly, at least, if not very much, correct about that. So they just wanted to sweep it under the rug, so to speak. But over time, particularly recently, in retrospect, the Austrians are beginning to realize, well, the word can get out, that because you can prove that we were victims as much as the rest of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it was they took one tack, now they're taking the other tack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the book is Death March Escape. The writer's Jack Hirsch.
Yeah.
We're out of time, Jack.
Well, wow. I really enjoyed being here.
It just blew by. It really did. Why don't you let our listeners know where they can reach you or get a hold of you, email?
Sure. So the book Death March Escape, all one word, is a website, deathmarchescape.com. Also, my last name is spelled Hirsch, H-E-R-S-C-H.
Right.
And so there's davidhirsch.com, which would be my father's name. You can find me on Facebook. You can buy the book through Amazon.
Right.
You can buy the book through either one of those two websites. Or you can, you know, track me down on Facebook, and you can get in Barnes & Noble too, by the way.
Excellent.
Thanks for coming out and joining us. I know that you didn't come out here just to be on the show, which would have been cool, but you didn't do that.
but I'm glad I'm here, and I really.
Oh, we're totally happy that you're here, and it's been an honor having you. Trust me. You know, we love good stories, and this was a great story.
Thanks very much.
Next week we have Mike Bond, who's a triple or a quadruple kind of guy that's been on our show a few times. This time he's coming in with a book of poetry that he's written. It's called The Drum That Beats Within Us, and he'll be here with us next week. And the 21st of May, we have a special writer's block one-on-one with writer Chira Thompson.
Yes.
And,
who I have not seen in over 40 years.
This is Russ's friend that he went to high school with. And she's written a book. It's called A Time to Wander. And that'll be May 21st. Until then, we're just rolling along on our normal Thursday nights. And again, Jack, thank you for coming in. It's a major pleasure having you.
My pleasure.
And for Russ and myself and the Writer's Block and LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.